You're listening to an ESA podcast brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. ESA, promoting the science of ecology.
I'm Christine Buckley, and this is Field Talk, a podcast produced by the Ecological Society of America. In Field Talk, we explore the work of scientists whose research has been published in the Society's journals, Ecology, Ecological Applications, and Ecological Monographs. Today we're talking with Dr. Rory Wilson, a professor of aquatic biology and head of the Institute of Environmental Sustainability at the University of Swansea in Wales. His research focuses on diving seabirds, and in his study published in the November issue of Ecological Monographs, he and his colleagues explore why some of these aquatic birds have lost the ability to fly altogether. Dr. Wilson, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for speaking to me today.
So, why do some birds in general lose the ability to fly over the course of their evolution?
It would seem a ridiculous thing to give up the power of flight when you can fly. Certainly, if I could fly, I wouldn't bother giving it up. But there are quite compelling cases for giving up flight, for example, that if you've got wings but you like scampering around in undergrowth and there's not really a possibility to fly, then why have wings? With regard to water birds, if you want to dive particularly well and you have large wings, then you've got problems taking these large wings down with you in the water column and all the muscles associated with these large wings. So that's a good reason really not to have large wings, assuming you're not using your wings to swim underwater.
What's the difference between what a wing has to do in the air and what flippers would have to do underwater?
Yeah, well, that's exactly the point, and that is that water is, of course, much more viscous than air, and if you wish to fly through the air, then you need effectively large wings, large surface area, low wing loading. As you reduce the size of your wings, it becomes harder and harder to fly. And the reverse is really true in water, that if you're swimming through this very viscous medium, you need to have wings that are small to be ideal. And the various solutions that birds have adopted to swimming underwater using wings are the case of some albatrosses and some shearwaters, for example, which use their wings half-folded and swim underwater and are really rather bad at it by pumping up and down with the wings. But they can fly quite well in the air. And sort of the next stage, if you like, down the ladder is to do what all auks actually do, which is to use their wings for swimming underwater, and they fold them even more. And the wing is actually reduced. And for that reason, when auks fly, they fly at, 80 kilometres an hour or not at all. And it's terribly energetically expensive for them to do so. And the only other option to push the envelope in an even more extreme direction is what penguins do, and that's reduce the wing even more so it becomes a tiny flipper with a very high wing loading if they were to fly. But it means they're fabulous for underwater swimming, and they've gone so far that in fact they can't fly anymore.
In your recent work, you're studying flightless cormorants, and they are in the Galapagos Islands, and they have lost the ability to fly altogether, even though they're in a taxonomic group where other cormorants all have the ability to fly. So what were the conditions that might have led to these diving birds losing their ability to fly, whereas others in their family still can fly?
The thing is, the cake's got two sides to it, if you like. One side is, what are the advantages of flying? And the other side is, what are the advantages in not flying? And the advantages in flying for a bird are, first and primarily, and this is thought to be the reason why birds flew in the first place, is you can escape predators. It's a great thing to be able to do, to leap in the air and just flap away when the fox stands underneath you and gets all upset about it. And if you live in a place where there are no predators, land predators of that type, then immediately all this energy and developmental processes that go into putting together flight systems become more questionable. Now, all other cormorants, bar the Galapagos cormorant, which is flightless, can fly, and the ability to fly was probably originated because of the predator pressure. But once you can fly, then the advantages in being able to do so means you can have your nest on one island and you can fly a long way very quickly to prey sources, which are far away. On the other hand, if prey is very dense and very close, perhaps you might not need to fly. So the Galapagos cormorant lives in a place with warm water, predictable and relatively high prey density, and where it benefits the cormorant to just be able to dive well. And if it can dive better than other cormorants by simply not having all the flight apparatus, then it's a good reason to get rid of it.
You've done research on various types of diving seabirds around the world. How do you measure the swimming and diving ability of these birds?
Yeah, there's a relatively new approach to examining what seabirds do at sea, and that's logging technology. These are tags you put on your animals, and these tags will record elements of what they do when they're at sea. In the study on the Galapagos cormorant, we were putting on GPS loggers, which then simply store the bird's position within the logger, and you plonk these things on. You use tape to put them on the bird's backs and leave them on for a day or two, and they jump in the sea and swim around. And every time they're at the surface, they take the position from GPS satellites, just much as you would when you're in your car. And it stores this information. And then when the birds come back, you take them off and you say, ooh, that's where it's been, you know. And the other thing is to put other types of recording technology, for example, depth gauges we used in the Galapagos cormorant study, where you record the depth every second. And so when they dive, you can see the descent rates, you can see the time they spend underwater, you can see the maximum depths they achieve, the time it takes them to get to the surface, and the times of the day they're diving, and all these other parameters which are useful for defining what's going on in their lives. And in particular, if you combine depth data with GPS data, then you have the bird's position in three dimensions as they go along their foraging tracks.
How good are they at swimming compared to, let's say, other swimming birds like penguins?
Well, nothing can touch a penguin, says he foolishly. That's just because I'm besotted with penguins. The cormorants are incredibly good at foraging underwater, but I've been terribly impressed just watching cormorants. I think, you know, Galapagos cormorant's good for 3, possibly 4 meters a second underwater. What does that translate into in miles per hour? 12 miles an hour or something like that, which is really fast. They have a nominal swimming speed of about 1.7, 1.8 meters a second, which is pretty fast for traveling under the water.
Are you considering future studies on these Galapagos cormorants?
Well, I'll tell you what's next, and that is what's actually on the cards and what we're doing right now, and it is fabulously exciting. Like a couple of years ago, I sat down with a group and we said, let's create a single generic tag which you can put on any animal. One of the things we've done is we've put all the trendy aspects of technology that I've been using in penguins and cormorants into one generic tag, and now we're making tags and sorting out software so that anybody working on any animal that's large enough to carry this tag can find out the sort of information about these animals that we've been finding out about seabirds. So I've got a list on the wall of the projects we've got going. We've got or have had them on badgers, cheetahs, leopards, seals, fur seals, whales, elephant seals, sunfish, whale sharks, lemon sharks, wandering albatrosses, cormorants, crocodiles, turtles, quite a long list. So it'll tell you where the animal goes, even if it goes underground or underwater. It's got a dead reckoning system. It'll tell you the energy it expends. It'll tell you the behavior that the animal's exhibiting, and it'll tell you about the environment through which the animal is moving, and we're getting this all sorted out with software which we shall put free on the web, and then people can just get hold of this tag and they'll say, well, our issue is whooping cranes. Their life will be hugely facilitated because they'll just be able to put them on, run it through the software and say, ah, now we know about whooping cranes. But we really hope that this approach, because it's been so powerful in the seabirds we've been doing, will help people working on a whole variety of animals.
So how does one become a diving bird ecologist? Did you start out studying ocean science, or were you first besotted with birds?
I was besotted with penguins from the age of 4, but don't tell anyone. And I studied zoology at university, and then subsequent to that thought, well, I need to get into penguins here, and did my PhD actually in South Africa on the African penguin. And it's really just a question of refining your studies more and more. And when I think back to the times when I went out to Marcus Island, which is where I did my PhD, and I stood on the island and watched all these penguins jumping in the water and swimming away and then just disappearing, and thinking, heavens, how am I going to find out what's going on at sea? That's what my thesis was on. That we've got to a stage now where we put high tech on these birds, and they go away and they come back, and we take it off, plug it into the computer, and I look at a book that's been written by a bird that tells me exactly where it's been and what it's been doing there, and the knowledge that, you know, these are secrets that are being aired for the first time in a piece of technology that's being written by the animal itself, and the aha effect is huge. How fast they're going, and oh, for heaven's sake, I never thought they did this, for example. It's every time we go and put a piece of technology such as this on a new seabird, I can't wait to get it off. I mean, it's hugely rewarding because there's no literature, there's no books that are written by these for these animals. They have to be written by them themselves, so it's all new.
That was Dr. Rory Wilson, a professor of aquatic biology and the head of the Institute of Environmental Sustainability at the University of Swansea. I'm Christine Buckley. Thanks for listening to Field Talk.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. Music was provided by Dr. Nicholas Catelli. For a link to Dr. Catelli's homepage, more information about ESA, or additional podcasts, please visit www.esa.org. Thanks for listening.